Okay. Before we start over, before we start again, and before I forget, next week is the last class for me in this course, and I've asked the faculty from our group, from Institu, to come and tell you about our internships. So this is mostly targeted to the M2 students. The CID students, you can be busy this summer, as I understand. If you want to spend some time working on a project, we could consider this. But the presentation next week, we'll do that at the end of class at noon, will be mostly for research internships for the M2 students who have to do 4 to 6 months on a research project. Okay, so back to the conceptual model. So, what is a conceptual model? How do you build it? Interestingly, you won't find much literature about this. And the stuff I'm telling you about here, I don't think I've seen it really described in the same way in the book. I've already shown this diagram, which is what I called at the time the conceptual model. If I wanted to be precise, I would call this a meta model, because it's not the model of one application, it's sort of a generic model of what I mean by a conceptual model. And the idea is that when you interact with a computer system, you need to have a way to tell the system what you want it to do. So you need to have a way to input commands. Inputting a command may take some time. So while you are inputting the command, whether you're typing it, or you're dragging something, or you're speaking, or you're touching, or you're whatever, you should get some feedback that tells you that the system is understanding what you're starting to say. And at some point, the command is specified, and it will trigger an internal or set of internal operations in the system. These operations will probably operate in some internal objects, and the result of these operations or the changes in the objects should be brought back to the user through responses. So, an example of a command is I want to navigate a document, so I use a scroll bar. So, while I use the scroll bar, there's two ways to look at it. Either I am moving the scroll bar, nothing happens except moving the thumb, and I get this feedback. And when I release the button, it says, okay, scroll, and show me the result. But I can also have an incremental scrolling command where as I move the thumb in the scroll bar, I get the feedback that the thumb is moving, but I also get mini-scrolling operations that give a response. So the granularity of these two loops can be at different scales. So having this generic conceptual model in mind, creating the conceptual model for a particular application or system means that I will need to identify the objects, the operations, the commands, the feedback, and the responses. Keeping in mind that this is maybe hidden from the user, and this is more what Norman called the system image, what the user would see. So when I'm talking of objects and operations here, it's for example, a file, and the operation is delete a file. In the interface, the command will be, well, type maybe a command in the command line interface, or drag a file to the trash. So the way I recommend to go about this is to start from right to left, is identify the objects, what I call the objects of interest for the user, what it is your application is about. If it's about don't know, text editing, well, your objects are going to be the characters and the words and sentences and paragraphs and the sections and all that. If your application is, a social networking site, well, the objects will be, posts and things like this. So you start really with what the user is supposed to manipulate with that application. From there, you can identify operations, what you want to do with those objects. And then you identify the commands. By commands, I mean really this whole loop here of how the user will actually trigger those operations. But of course, it's not a linear thing where you do step one, step two, step three, and you're done. As you end up step three, or even step two, you realize you maybe need more objects, and then you will have commands that you want to make look more like more consistent. So it's really an iterative process. So concretely, one way to describe this conceptual model is to use what I call interaction tables. And one structure for these tables that I find quite useful is to have the tables of objects and the tables of operations. Now in the table for the objects, I have the object of interest, which is not something the user sees as such. So for example, a file or a post on a blog or something. And then I can describe the representations of those objects, how the user will see those objects on the screen. So if I'm talking about a file, the one representation with an icon, whose image represents the type of the file, plus the name of the file written underneath. Now, these objects have properties. So a file, it has a path or the folder it belongs to. It has a type, it has a name, it has a size, it has a creation date, it has all sorts of properties. Now, I want to list here only the properties that are of interest to the user. So if you are in Unix, a file is an inode number, which is sort of its location on the hard drive. Normally, users don't care about this. Although if you're a sysadmin, you may. So. But here, I'm only interested in things that are meaningful to the user. Now, one type of object can have multiple representations. And that's important. And one thing you can do already, just between these two things, is to check the visibility principle. Is it the case that each and every property of an object is visible, or perceivable, if we don't talk only about a graphical user interface, is every property perceivable in at least one representation of the object? So, if I think the size of an object is of relevance, but I only have an icon representation that shows its name and not its size, there is a problem. Or a likely problem. Because it means that to find the size, I'll probably have to create an operation that says, well, show me the size of the object, and this is not really what we want. We want state to be directly perceivable in at least one representation. And in fact, if I wanted to describe the finder with this, I would have to add a second representation of files, which is in the list view, I have a record, a line, where I can see the name, I can see the icon, I can see the size, I can see the creation date, etc., etc. And then the last comment I put here is the operations. What can I do with this object? And in general, for every object, the operations are going to be how to create a new object of this type. And in some cases, the user, you don't want the user to create those objects, or it doesn't make any sense to create those objects. So maybe there's no creation operation, but you need to ask yourself this question. Should the user be able to create these objects? Delete, same thing. And then a number of other operations here are going to be, how can I change the properties of this object? If the object has a name, well, it's likely that there's an operation to change the name of the object. Now, an object has a file as a size, but that's not something I can change directly. So I'm unlikely in this example to have an operation called resize. But my point here is that you can ask yourself these questions systematically. So you make sure you don't forget anything, and you can make informed choices. If my object is an image, well, resizing the image may mean something. So you have to at least look at operations that create objects, delete objects, and change their properties. Now, of course, we have more application-dependent operations that involve different object types. I mean, something like printing, for example, is going to be quite specific of files or documents. But what you'll find is that if you use more properties, a number of operations become simply editing the property. So if I didn't have the size as a property here, and I would maybe at some point have an operation where I need to show the size of an object. But once I make its property, I can have more, what's called, consistent operations to access and change its properties. So I'm not saying it, you know, it's always design decisions, but think of maybe sometimes you can simplify operations by adding properties to objects, sometimes by creating new objects. An example that is frequent is, if you have an object with a bunch of properties, you want to capture these properties into a style. So we'll see in a moment a graphical editor. So I have shapes, graphical shapes, and they have a color, and they have a fill color, and a border color, and the border thickness, and etc., etc. Well, oftentimes, it's useful to have a way to capture all of these properties into one object that you call a style, so that you can then assign the style to multiple objects. In drawing tools, it's not that common, but it's very common in text editing. So the paragraph style, where you have the margins and the font and the font size, etc., you make the collection of these object of these attributes or properties, a new object you call the style. And once you have this, a new object in this column, you have to decide, okay, what are the operations on this particular object? How does it look in my interface? Where do I find the styles? So that's the object table. And then there's the operations table. Well, in a sense, this is pivoting this along this dimension. And you want here to make sure you have all the operations that you have listed here for all of the objects. So if you have a delete operation for a file object, I need here to describe, okay, the delete file operation, how will the user trigger this operation? And here we find the four things we had in the diagram. The command, what does the user do? The feedback, what does the system do while the user is specifying the command? And the response, what does the system do once the command is specified? So to delete a file, I have, say, two commands. I can drag the icon to the trash, or I can select the file and hit the delete key. In one case, the feedback is that the ghost of the icon will follow the cursor. In the second case, well, the selection will have a feedback, which is the icon gets selected, gets highlighted. And the response is, in the first case, I've dragged to the trash, so my icon is on the trash, so the icon disappears, and maybe the trash gets bigger or flashes or something to say that it's eaten the file. In the other case, when I hit the delete key, well, I could make the file disappear, but again, causality principle, it may be better to animate the file to the trash. So you know that it is the same thing that would have happened if you had dragged it to the trash. So if you do this systematically, you progressively build the description of your interface. And in general, what you do in parallel with that is what's called a wireframe or a sketch of what things look like on the screen. But in the early stages, don't get hooked up too much on how things get laid out on the screen and things like this. I think too much of UI design is seen as pure visual design of, oh, I need to put this there, put that there, and this has to be this color. This is really, to me, the second step where you try to make things logical and visually consistent. But it's really critical that you've identified all the objects, all the operations, and look at all the ways you can trigger these operations.
And the feed forward is the representation?
I'm sorry?
The feed forward is the representation?
So, no, the feed forward, so, this is the simplest version of these tables.
Okay.
And you have to see this as something you are allowed to tweak and twist, and if you want to add columns or even another table, feel free to do it. When we design interfaces based on the instruments paradigm that I talked about last time, we change those tables so the instruments appear explicitly in there. So for your specific question, which is feed forward, so what is feed forward? Anybody know? Because I don't think of this. Define feed forward.
I would say it's like affordance, the visual representation of affordance.
Yes, that's a good definition. So the feedback is when the system tells you what you're doing. The feed forward is when the system tells you what it is you can do. Right. So when I'm doing a drag and drop, if I drag the icon, there's the shadow of the icon that's following my cursor. This is feedback. System tells me, yes, you are actually moving this icon. But if I go over a folder and the folder highlights, this is feed forward, because the system tells me, hey, if you drop it here, this could happen. So it's information about possible futures. So it is indeed an affordance. It shows me what the system can do. So in our case, for this type of example, feedback and feedforward are really tightly intertwined, so we would describe them together. So what I'm going to do... So here I talked about the type of systematic verification you can do, make sure every property is visible, and make sure you have operations for creating, deleting, and changing properties, or if you don't, you know why you don't have them. Here, the other things to check is your operations here, or all the operations that you have here. The type of check you can do regarding commands and feedback and response is more about consistency. Similar operations try to make it so they are triggered by similar types of command. Or if you don't, again, know why you don't do it. Look also at ways to, for each command, to have a more, say, novice mode and a more expert mode, which is what I did here. The drag and drop versus the delete key. So there's a lot of things you can do on just this representation without actually implementing anything or even knowing exactly how things are going to look on the screen. So I'm going to show two case studies here on image editing and vector-based drawing. I encourage you, and I think you will, and I don't think I know you will do in the TA sessions other examples. I don't know if it would be one of these. And if not, you probably will want to practice it. As you've seen, if you looked at the exams that I give, there's often an exercise in building a conceptual model for a little application or part of an application. So you've been warned. Okay, so drawing tool. So creating images. That's a very large class of applications. And one way of analyzing this is to say, well, you know, okay, I want a tool to make drawings. What does it mean? What kind of drawings? If I show you this, what do you see? Don't think too hard. It's not hard.
Circle and rectangle.
Thank you. Rectangle. Looks like a square from here. It's parallax. Yes. Well, or is it? Maybe it's a set of pixels that happen to have been carefully arranged so they look really like if it were a circle and rectangle. So maybe I can erase those pixels, which would happen in a tool such as Paint, Photoshop, GIMP. Now it may also be that it is in fact really a rectangle and circle, and I can move them independently, and here, you know, move the circle, and maybe I could set the rectangle on top of it. So, in fact, I had a third example originally, which was a planner that I've dropped because of lack of time. But you could see this as a set of contours. So I have one here, I have a second one here, and I have a third one there. And they define three zones, this one, and this one. And I can color them differently. So if you think of a geographical map with rows, this is more what I'm talking about. And there used to be a system that allowed you to edit these things. It was very interesting, but it doesn't exist anymore, so I dropped. But the point is there are other ways to think of this drawing than just as a set of pixels or as a set of shapes. And fancy animation here. So I can put the rectangle on top, so I have this notion that objects are superposed in a 2D and a half model. So based on this analysis, we can see two categories of tools. One where I'm editing bitmaps, that is images made out of pixels. And the basic object is the pixel. But since there's a bunch of pixels, manipulating one by one is probably not always ideal. So I would probably want to manipulate sets of pixels, arrays. And so if I'm thinking in terms of these pixels and areas, well, I want to be able to define an area, and I want to apply an operation to the pixels in this area. And defining an area, maybe I want to outline it myself, or I want maybe to have a system selected for me by saying, give me all the things that are the same color as this pixel, or this kind of things. Or maybe I can define an area like it has a pretty fine shape, or a circle, or a rectangle. Now, the other way to think of this is I'm editing vectors, not vectors in the mathematical sense. I'm editing shapes, I guess, would be a better term. So the images are not made out of individual pixels, at least they all eventually are, but at this point I'm thinking of them as a collection of shapes. And so my objects are these shapes that are arranged spatially and in this half dimension where they are strictly ordered from front to back. And so the basic operations are to create new shapes by specifying their geometry, their actual shape, and their graphical attributes, their colors and things like this. To modify this geometry and attributes, modifying the geometry will include moving an object, and changing the stacking order of these shapes. So you see that you have two very different sets of objects and operations. So then we can start putting this into tables. So here I'm starting with the objects table for bitmap editing. And I've, I'm not quite sure what I have here. Yes. So, first operation is to specify an area to tell the system this is a subset of the pixels I'm going to want to do something with. So selecting an area, well, if you look at any tool like Photoshop or GIMP or Paint, etc., you have a zillion ways of selecting areas. You have the rectangle selection tool, you have the lasso selection tool, you have these magic wands which select based on the colors, etc., etc. They all have a similar type of interaction where you specify with drag and drop or with a tracing interaction where you, in the case of the lasso, or just a single point in the case of the magic wand, which is not here. But the thing is, when you select this tool, the cursor changes, so it's really an instrumental paradigm here where you feel like you're taking this tool in your hand, you select, and as you go, the system shows you with the ghost outline the exact set of pixels you're selecting. And then when the thing is finished, you have the area that is made visible to you by what we call the marching ants. You know, this little dotted line that sort of looks like it's moving. And now once I've selected an area, well, the selected area is an object in my conceptual model. And, you know, if you've ever worked with Photoshop, the fact that you have one selected area at a time is to me, at least, because I'm not a very good Photoshop user, is always very stressful because I always, you know, you spend a lot of time selecting your thing because, of course, you can add to the selection, remove from the selection, etc., etc. And you spend a lot of time selecting the exact right pixels, and then you want to apply something, and you lose the selection. So there are ways in Photoshop, at least, to memorize a selection and call it back. But it's not really very...
Someone has to tell you about that.
You have to know it exists. The selection, and that's where I find this type of analysis interesting. And what I'm doing here is really using it as an analysis tool. So you can analyze an existing interface. And I would strongly recommend when you design a new application to deconstruct the existing ones with this, too, because it's really a way to understand what was the underlying conceptual model, if there was one. So if you deconstruct Photoshop in this way, you find that they have only one selection. If you dig further, you find that you can actually store a selection and recall it, but it's not really made turn into a first-class object in the interface. You don't have a palette somewhere with all your stored selections or something of that nature.
And they use layers sometimes for that?
Yes. Yeah. No, I didn't go into layers here.
Ah.
but yes, layers are a way each layer, no, each layer in fact memorizes its own selection. But recalling the selection from the layer, you have to, I never know if it's command or control or some weird combination of click on the layer, and if you do the wrong thing, you lose the selection and it's gone.
And it's pretty annoying that if you see everything, like when we were seeing the circle and the rectangle, you see it as a whole image, but if you want to select just the circle, you have to know that you have to select the layer that contains the circle, and it's pretty annoying. I just want to select this whole thing.
Yeah. I know many times you select some things, but oh, there's no pixels in this layer.
Yeah.
Well, give me a layer with pixels. Anyway, so so selection is a big thing. In fact, in Photoshop, there's a whole menu this long that's called select or selection. Then once you have a selection, you want to do things to it. One easy thing to do is to fill it with a solid color, which you can do in various ways. So to select the whole shade, you can select the paint bucket tool, and you just click inside the area, and it fills the thing. Since it's a one-click operation, the feedback is just the cursor change when you select the paint bucket, but then it just, the fact that the area fills is just the result, the response. The other way is, once you have done a selection, in fact, a number of the other tools, such as the brush tool, will only paint inside the selection. So to paint the selected area, I can create the outline, and then I select the brush tool, and then I paint inside, and the system will sort of not go outside the selected area. Now, once you have the selected area, because it's an object and its property is the shape that you have, or the set of pixels you have selected, you want to be able to modify it. And a lot of the commands in the select menu, in the case of Photoshop, are about selecting modifying the selection. So for example, you can invert the selection so that everything that was selected becomes unselected and vice versa. Or you can extend the selection where your selection grows by 1 pixel or 2 pixels, etc. So all of these commands in the case of Photoshop, which was my inspiration here, are in one menu. And there are usually one-shot commands. You select the command and there's a thing, and so you don't have any feedback really. I mean, the fact that the menu shows up is not, well, it should be mentioned as feedback, but at some point, because without saying, and so you only see the effect of this. And I think they could have made it so that modifying the selection would be done in a more direct manipulation way, or with a specific tool palette rather than this menu. I mean, I don't know. I if I were to redesign Photoshop, which I'm not paid for doing, I would certainly look at that. Because when you have things that can only be done through many commands, it should raise a red light and say, well, can we do better? Can we introduce new objects? Can we introduce different operations? Can we do something to make it more direct? Similarly, we have a set of commands to transform the selected area. So, famous one in Photoshop is the filters. And again, the interaction with the filters in Photoshop is pretty frustrating, because he has this long list of filters. They have names you've never heard of before. And this is a case where the feed forward is really missing, because I would like, as I go on the filters, that gives me some kind of preview of what's going to happen. But once you've picked one, then you're usually presented with some kind of dialog box with a bunch of parameters. And even though you get one preview that is usually too small, it's still, I think, not really matching what the user is trying to achieve. In particular, you often want to compare different sets of settings. But here you can't. You can do one setting and say, yes, or no. And if you find something you kind of like, you'd likely will say, well, I'll memorize this, I'm going to try it, but see if I can do better. And then you would like to be able to get back to previous settings. So again, if I were to redesign this, I would make filters more of a first-class object in the system. And not just filters, but filter settings. Because I think, and I don't use Photoshop often, so there's probably a zillion things I've missed, but I don't know that you can store filter settings, multiple settings for a given filter. Each filter tends to remember the last settings you used, but that's it. And that's not enough for what you do. But again, the point here is to illustrate how putting this into this context helps you to reason about the interface and generate new ideas. Now, your ideas are not always going to be right, and my ideas are probably as wrong as anybody else's, but at least it gives you ideas that then you can test with users in brainstorming or design sessions after you've tried to make them consistent with your conceptual model. So example of objects that you find in a tool like Photoshop, there is this notion of area, although in Photoshop there is only one, it's called a selection, and there's one and only one. I would certainly want to be able to manage multiple selections. They are represented by this marching ants blinking outline. Their properties is the set of pixels inside the area, so that's what you see with this surrounding, although again, is that the best representation? Sometimes I don't like this blinking thing. I would like to have a thing where it would erase everything that's not selected and only show what is selected, so I know exactly what is selected. And I can do that. So the operation we talked about, how we define this area, modify it, fill it, were the three ones I showed in this example, but of course there are many more. We talked about using a brush to paint. Well, brushes are, in fact, it's something, if anything, that's quite well done in Photoshop. There are first-class objects. You have a menu of the brushes. You can create new brushes. You can set their size and shape, etc. And you can store them, and you can, in fact, import or maybe even buy libraries of brushes. So that's an example where the brush is really a first-class object in Photoshop. Now, this is an example where tool palette. I'm always fighting with students when you are going to try this. You're going to put in your objects things that I don't consider objects. And the tool palette, I would not normally put it in there. In general, a user interface element, a menu, a button, a scroll bar, is not an object in itself, because it's there only for the user to be able to achieve one of the, or several of the commands that we've described elsewhere. So I don't consider this objects of interest for the user. The user doesn't care about the menu. He cares about what he can do with the menu. So he cares about the objects that are hiding behind the interface, not the objects that are in the interface to allow him to do some of the commands. The reason I put tool palette here is because the tool palette is, well, a floating window with a list of tools, and you can, in the property done interface, you would want this to become a first-class object, so people, users, can create their own tool palettes, can save them, can send them by email as you send the file. I showed that a little bit at the end of the CPN video. We also saw it in the Métis video, where he was using GIMP as an example, and taking bits and pieces of GIMP and putting together its own tool palettes, if you remember. Once you start doing this thing, then for the user, a tool palette becomes a real object that they can manipulate, it can create. create new ones, they can modify them, they can store them, etc., etc. But in general, interface objects should not be objects in your conceptual model. Okay, so that was bitmap-based editing. And now vector-based editing. Well, it's a bit simpler, or at least more straightforward. I'll start with the objects for this one. Well, the obvious objects are the shapes, right? So vector-based shapes. Shapes defined by a geometry, set of points in general, or dimensions, or geometrical values, and the set of graphical attributes like colors and textures and things like this. And the operations are really create a shape, delete a shape, which I don't describe in the other table, so I didn't put it there, modify a shape, change the graphical attributes. So modify would be modify the geometry, and change attributes would be change the graphical attributes. So we'll get back to the rest of this table. So once I have this shape, I want to be able to create one of these shapes. Typically, I'm selecting an object in the palette, and I use click and drag or some interaction, depending on which type, to specify the geometry. But usually, I only specify the geometry, and there's a notion of current attributes that are specified elsewhere, and I don't specify the attributes when I create the shape. It just starts with the current attributes, and then I can change the attributes. Select the pencil, so which one is this?
Create an object.
Oh yeah, no, so this was to create a pick and drag, so a shape that is defined by a diagonal, essentially, so it can be a square, a rectangle, an oval, etc. And then this is a shape that has multiple control points, so you need to click multiple times. And then you always end up having, in many cases, you have this notion of selection in your interface. So you need a category of operations to select which are the objects that other operations are going to operate on. So selecting one more object, I can click on the background and drag to get a selection rectangle, and you have all the selection modes that you know about. And the selection will be represented in interface by handles, typically around the objects. Once I've selected objects, I can modify the geometry, modify the attributes, modify the stacking order. So all of these will start by selecting the object explicitly, or rather operate on the current selection. So if I want to modify the geometry, I select it, I get those handles, and then I can move the handles to reshape the object. And that's done in an incremental way. To modify the graphical attributes, well, usually I use a dialog box, or preferably an inspector, that is a separate representation that is really something showing all the attributes. And when I edit them in the inspector, they immediately affect the selected object. And change the stacking order, so well, you typically have the commands to bring the object to the front, to the back, etc., etc. So this is fairly simple, although I don't have time, but we could go into could this be made better. Something that is that we've talked about before is the notion of how to align objects, so the layout thing. Just being able to move objects freely is not enough. You often want other ways that are more constrained to move objects and to align them, distribute them, etc. The other big thing is how to deal with groups of objects. Now, I can select several objects to apply a command to all of them at once, but I can also turn these multiple selections into objects themselves by creating groups. Groups in general are purely hierarchical in those tools. Once an object is in one group, it cannot be in two separate groups that are independent. Why is that? Well, it's interesting. Also, oftentimes, once an object is inside a group, you cannot edit that object by itself. You need to ungroup, edit the object, and regroup. In some tools, Illustrator is an example, you can in fact can do a kind of zoom inside the group. So you get in the group, then you can edit those objects individually, and then you can get out of the group. So you don't lose the group as such, like you have to do in many other tools. And again, you know, doing this thing kind of systematically, not for the whole interface, because something like Photoshop is huge, but if you get a specific function that you need to build into the tool you're designing, and going into various tools and see how it's done and describing it this way will really help you figure out what is the design space and explore new possibilities. So here we find the tool palette again, which I put here to show some consistency across the tools. But the attribute inspector is another example of something that is really, to me, on the edge between conceptual objects and the pure interface objects. I would not put the dialog box here, because the dialog box is part of the command sequence that you go through to achieve something. But an inspector stays on the screen all the time, and it becomes really part of your mental model, I think, as you use the software. And so it makes sense to put the attribute inspector here. But once you put it here, you should say, well, how can I capture collections of attributes so I can reuse them later, so I can store them maybe in a file and turn them into real first-class objects? And so another way to look at this is to say, well, no, the attribute inspector is actually not the real object. The real object would be a style. And then the attribute inspector would be a representation of the style. Mm-hmm. Right? So, again, I'm not, you know, this is not the definitive way of doing this kind of tools. I'm just trying to show here a little bit of the process you go through when you reason inside this framework, instead of, you know, sketching things randomly of what's going to happen when the user clicks here or clicks there. I think here what I'm trying to show is that it's sort of a little bit more abstract level, but still quite concrete, based on what the user will be able to do. So a couple of rules to help build the conceptual model. You can group commands by category, so things are a little bit more structured. So for the example I was giving, there are things where you manage the workspace, like the windows and the tool palettes and things like this. This is sort of one set of commands that you will find across different types of application. There is, for example, global versus local editing, editing the layout of objects versus editing the attributes and the shapes of each object. So try to group things together, which will also help you distribute the work across several people. Verify completeness, same operations in both tables. Each property should be visible and editable, or if not, you should know why. And verify consistency, which is one simple example, is similar interactions should have similar effects, and really try to build in more consistency as you go. You can apply the design principles I talked about to this process, verification, identifying new objects. I tried to show that with the inspector. So you have an object has a set of properties that are attributes. You build an inspector for these attributes. Well, once you have an inspector, maybe you have a new type of objects there, which you call a style.